From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the unending confrontation of Israel and the Palestinians can seem to the world at every turn like deja vu all over again. Now, it's exploded again and threatens to get much bloodier soon. The big difference this time? The whole region is in flux, with civil war and borders up for grabs. This hour On Point, Israel and the Palestinians on the brink again. This time, in a region of fire, you can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see this time in the conflict? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in a moment from Nicholas Burns, Rashid Khalidi, and Alan Elsner. But first, Michelle Dunn joins me from Washington, senior associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former Mideast specialist at the State Department. Michelle Dunn, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here we see all of this 200 targeted strikes by the Israelis today. We're told 150 or more rockets coming up out of Gaza. We have seen this movie before in many respects. Does all of the flux that we're looking at in the region matter? Does the changed context in the region-wide matter in terms of this conflict, Michelle?
Well, as you say, Tom, in a way, this feels like a rerun of a bad movie we've seen before. And indeed, there have been these kind of exchanges between Israel and Hamas nearly every year since 2007, in one form or another, some bigger, some smaller. But there are some changes here. Hamas's situation is different now than what it was even during the last big conflict between Israel and Hamas, which was in 2012. Hamas had a falling out with Syria because of the Syrian uprising. It had a bit of a falling out with Iran. It has worse relations with Egypt than it had back in 2012. And it's only friends in the region now are Qatar and Turkey. So Hamas, and that makes a difference in terms of who could possibly mediate this conflict, who could work with Hamas to bring about an end to this conflict. So that has changed. For Israel, too, the strategic picture is somewhat different. Israel, of course, is extremely concerned about what it sees going on in Syria, Iraq, et cetera. The United States has made the argument to Israel, and we've seen this recently. President Obama published an op-ed in an Israeli newspaper just a couple of days ago, and the White House coordinator for the Middle East, Phil Gordon, is in Israel, made a statement yesterday. The United States is trying to make the argument to Israel that the changed regional context and all this conflict in the region means Israel should be more eager to make peace with the Palestinians while they still have a Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, who's very amenable to a negotiated solution, and also that somehow resolving the Palestinian question would deflate extremism and radicalism in the region. But so far, the current Israeli leadership, Prime Minister Netanyahu, has not been receptive to those arguments. And we've seen the Israelis less willing to negotiate peace with the Palestinians because of what's going on elsewhere in the region.
Is Israel worried that the flux elsewhere, the civil war in Syria, the Islamic State now announced or declared and border posts down between Iraq and Syria and Iraq a mess. People talk about Jordan possibly becoming destabilized. Is Israel worried that the region-wide flux could come right up to the West Bank?
Certainly. Certainly Israel's worried about that. I mean, they've always been worried that any kind of border that Israel could have with a Palestinian state would be a vulnerable border, but even more so now. And as you said, ISIS has made direct threats to Jordan, is trying to drum up anti-monarchy sentiment inside of Jordan. And so that's of concern. Now, in the statements that U.S. officials have made, President Obama's op-ed, for example, he specifically argued that the United States has been working very hard with Israeli security officials. There is General John Allen has been there for some time working with the Israelis on some very very tough security arrangements along the border so that there could be, you know, Israel could feel safe through the use of technology, weapons. I mean, of course, we've seen the United States has provided to Israel Iron Dome and other kinds of weapon systems to defend Israel from missile attack. So, you know, as I said, we, you know, unfortunately, we see the U.S. and Israeli leaderships making the argument from the opposite perspectives. The Israelis saying, because what's going on in the region, we can't make peace. And the United States saying, because of what's going on in the region, you should make peace and get the arrangements in place now to defend yourself.
We're very far from that path as we speak today. 40,000 reservists authorized for call up here. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, saying this may be a protracted military engagement in or around Gaza, Palestinians expressing fury, Israelis expressing fury, some looking another way as well. Michelle Dunn at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the Middle East program there in Washington. Michelle, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Air raid sirens here sounding in Jerusalem earlier this week. In response, of course, to Palestinian Hamas rockets out of Gaza. And here, yesterday, people running from the site of an Israeli missile strike in Gaza. With us right now from Westport, Massachusetts, Nicholas Burns. He was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 05 to 08, one of the highest-ranking officials in the U.S. State Department, led negotiations on a long-term military assistance agreement with Israel, was U.S. Ambassador to NATO earlier, to Greece, big figure in American foreign policy, now a professor at the Kennedy School of Government, director of the Future of Diplomacy Project there at Harvard. Nicholas Burns, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
So, look across this horizon with us. Is something different this time, or are we locked in a kind of never-ending deja vu repeat here?
It's pretty much the same story. There's some differences, as Michelle pointed out, Tom, but you know, if you look at these rocket wars in the past, these wars between Hamas in Gaza and Israel, they've always been ended by outside mediators. In 2012, it was Hillary Clinton, working with the then president of Egypt, Mohammed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, who negotiated a truce in effect between the Israeli government of Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Hamas leadership. And I think, Tom, something similar is going to have to happen this time. Michelle pointed out that Qatar and Turkey are probably the only partners that Hamas trusts in the greater Middle East right now. Certainly Israel trusts the United States. I think the United States will have to intervene here diplomatically with one of those countries to try to convince both sides to stop, because as of this morning, as you said, 43 Palestinians dead, rockets being rained down on Gaza, but rockets being rained down on Israeli cities. And it's the duty of any government to defend its cities that are under attack. So both sides are going to continue until someone can convince them, some partners, to stop. And I think it does point out a larger role. When Secretary John Kerry was negotiating peace between Israel and the Palestinians, for his first year in office, he made 14 trips
to Ramallah
and Jerusalem. We didn't see this kind of thing happening, because when peace negotiations are underway, it does, I think, depress the attitudes of some of the more violent people to act out as they are in the Palestinian side, and now we've seen the Israeli response.
Nicholas Burns, why did that peace effort, so much poured into it by Secretary of State John Kerry, why did it so utterly fail?
I think it failed for two reasons. One, the Israelis couldn't go beyond a certain point because of problems within the coalition government headed by Prime Minister Netanyahu. He has significant figures to his right who did not want him to go that last mile for peace. And secondly, the Palestinians were fundamentally disunited. As you know, the Palestinian Authority, a moderate leadership in Ramallah, very different from the more radical, aggressive, and violent leadership of Hamas in Gaza. I think those are the principal factors, but I think it does...
But things collapsed when the Palestinians... Forgive me, but things collapsed when the Palestinians agreed to a unity government.
It collapsed then, and it collapsed because the Israelis couldn't go... because the Israelis couldn't restrain their settlement building, and that was a big factor in the Palestinian equations. I think you've got to put the onus of responsibility on both the Palestinians and the Israelis. I was just going to say, Tom, I think it defends and justifies the effort that Secretary Kerry put into those negotiations. A lot of people ridiculed him for trying so hard in what they saw as a hopeless cause, but at least he kept the peace on the ground between these two antagonists.
It seemed, when you step back and see how much flux is in this region now, I'm struck by how, in all the previous engagements like this, the rest of the region has been pretty well locked down. Authoritarian governments and pretty firm borders, even when there was conflict. Does it change the long-term outlook for this conflict, Israeli versus Palestinians, if the rest of the region is up in flames, in flux?
Well, it does, and I think the context is completely different now. The Middle East in 2014 is a burning region. The keystone state is Egypt, and Egypt is fundamentally divided between the military dictatorship, the more secular part of the population, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and the groups to its right, the radical groups. Syria, 22 million people, Tom. About half of those people are now homeless inside the country or outside because of that vicious civil war, and we've seen the march of ISIS, which is threatening, well, which has imposed a caliphate, an extremist religious state on northern Syria and western Iraq, threatening now to divide Iraq permanently. So this is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for 40, 50 years has been the central drama in the Middle East. It's no longer the central drama. And the problem for the Israelis is that these turbulations in the Arab world have now fundamentally destabilized all of its borders. The Syria border, the Lebanon border, the Jordanian border, because there's a weaker Jordanian state, and now there's ISIS in Jordan. And Sinai, of course, part of Egypt, but lies geographically between Egypt and Israel, now run by criminal gangs and terrorist groups. And so the Israelis really are facing a completely new, and I would say much more ominous, security situation for them, Hamas being just one of the problems they're facing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Protesters there waving Hamas flags and burning an Israeli flag in Gaza over the weekend, and that is before all the rockets started heading out of Gaza in those numbers we've seen in the last couple of days, and before all the bombs came in. 200 sites targeted by Israelis in Gaza so far today, we're told. We're talking this hour about Israel and the Palestinians squaring off in a region of on fire. There's been so much drama in the last couple of weeks. Here on Monday, Rachel Frankel, the mother of Naftali Frankel, one of the three Israeli boys kidnapped and killed, gave her sympathy to the family of the Palestinian teenager who was killed, apparently, in revenge.
No mother or father should go through what we are going now. And we share the pain of the parents of Muhammad Abu Khadir.
The Israeli Defense Minister, Moshe Yaalon, said in a statement that he was ashamed and shocked by the cruel murder of the Palestinian boy. The Israeli Defense Minister describing those behind it as Jewish terrorists. On Monday, in an interview with CNN, spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Mark Regev, said Israel condemned the killing of the Palestinian teenager, Muhammad Abu Khadir.
We promised to investigate. We promised to bring the perpetrators of that crime to justice. And guess what? We delivered. We've done exactly that. And it's important to say that these despicable murderers, the people who conducted this crime, they are for us people who we despise, people who have no place in our society.
Six arrests in Israel in the death of the Palestinian boy. But it's a bigger drama than just Israel and the Palestinians this time. Nicholas Burns is with us, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, to Greece, State Department spokesman for a long time, and Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs, right up at the top of the U.S. State Department. He's seen this from the inside of America's foreign policy lead institution. Joins us from Westport, Massachusetts. With us right now from Aix-en-Provence, France, is Rashid Khalili, Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia's School of International Public Affairs, author of Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, author of The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. Rashid Khalili, thank you very much for joining us. What do you see unfolding this time, sir?
Thanks, Tom. Well, I think that I differ a little bit from the people who've already offered their opinions. Mm-hmm. I think it's a bit of a mistake to compare this to earlier occasions when Israel was bombarding Gaza and rockets were being fired out of Gaza at Israeli cities. This goes back just a little bit further. It doesn't just go back to the collapse of the negotiations. I think it goes back to what we have been seeing in terms of a real increase in tensions, which are caused by the expansion of Israel's settlement enterprise all over the West Bank and the siege of Gaza. The pressure that's been put on the Palestinians has finally, led to an eruption. And the eruption started around issues of prisoners. It started with the attack on these three Israeli yeshiva students who were then murdered. And that was then used by Israel, even though they never proved who did it. They claimed Hamas did it. This was used by Israel for an incredible manhunt through the West Bank, storming through West Bank cities. Five Palestinians were shot down, several of them apparently in cold blood, killed as a part of this. And this has stoked the flames of all of this in a way that I think is a very, very important background. Finally, as far as Gaza is concerned, there is clearly a tit-for-tat aspect to it. But I think we have to remember that the tit, as it were, the Israeli bombardment of Gaza is like shooting fish in a barrel. As Nick Burns said, over 40 people have been killed, most of them civilians. Mercifully, so far, not one Israeli civilian has been killed. And that's usually approximately the casualty ratio. Many, many Palestinians are killed as Israel uses this very powerful war machine. And I would also add that Israeli spokespersons, Israeli security people were saying, for many, many days there, Hamas was apparently trying to restrain other groups that started the firing of rockets. And Israel could easily have tried to ratchet things down. They seem to have had an interest in ratcheting things up. That will never be reflected. The fact that you have a much higher Palestinian death toll, the fact that there's a background to this will never be reflected.
Rashid Khalidi, what would Israel's interest be in ratcheting things up now when there's already so much tension, flux, turmoil in the region? What would the interest be?
Well, one of their interests, very clearly, is to smash the possibility of the Palestinians uniting. Israel is apoplectic at the idea that the Palestinians will get their act together and will have some kind of unified leadership. They're much happier to negotiate endlessly without ever offering concessions to a weak, helpless Palestinian Authority in Gaza separated from a weakened Hamas. They want to smash, separate, divide, control the Palestinians. That's their objective. They have absolutely no intention of making any concessions in the direction of a Palestinian state. The whole settlement enterprise is directed to making a state impossible. It's done so. And that's what this government is about. It's not about a negotiation. So the reason the negotiations failed is that the Israeli government had absolutely no intention of agreeing to anything along the lines of Palestinian self-determination. And that's really the origin of where we're at. And that's why Israel intended to escalate against Hamas. I mean, the Israeli leaders said it very clearly. We're going to force you out of an agreement with Hamas to Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the PA in Ramallah.
Nicholas Burns, there's clearly a very strong emotional element that is eminent here. I mean, after the killings of the Israeli teams and the Palestinian team, but strategically, why would this be a good time for Israel or the Palestinians to take it, to push it to this point? And when Israelis look out at the turmoil in the region, how do they see their best play here? Is the two-state solution dead, as Rashid Khalidi asserts? Would they rather have a security lockdown as they see insecurity in the rest of the region?
Well, Tom, you're right to ask that question. We're looking at profound human emotions here, and the Palestinians and Israelis have been locked in an emotional, very divisive, very bitter dispute for 66 years, since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, since the dispersal of the Palestinians to refugee camps throughout the Middle East in that same year. But I must say, I was in office as Undersecretary of State during the Lebanon War of 2006 when Israel battled Hezbollah. Nothing good comes of these conflicts because both sides cannot achieve a victory. Israel cannot realistically invade Gaza with ground forces. It would be a disaster for the Israelis, a disaster for the people of Gaza, one of the most densely populated and poorest places on earth. Hamas cannot defeat Israel and will not defeat Israel by firing rockets at Ashdod and Ashkelon and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
But what about Rashid Khalidi's point that he says, look, they're under all this settlement, they're under occupation, the frustration is very high, this is going to happen?
Well, violence isn't the answer. And here's the divided aspect of the Palestinian community. You do have a mature, responsible leadership in Ramallah and the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, headed by Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, which wants to deal with Israel and frankly sometimes can't find an Israeli negotiating partner. Hamas, on the other hand, believes that the sword, the bullet, violence is the only way forward. It's how it justifies itself. And frankly, by lobbing rockets at Israeli cities, it is inviting a retaliatory response, and they know that by the Israelis. And so from an American perspective, and that's how I see things, Tom, obviously, we've got to step in diplomatically in a very tough way and try to separate these two, because all that will happen in the next week or two is that more innocent people will die on both sides. Rashid is right. If you look at the prior conflicts, the death toll among the Palestinians always much higher. But obviously, if you're an Israeli, if you're Prime Minister Netanyahu, you can't stand aside and see rockets fired at your major cities, your major population centers. So it does need Secretary John Kerry, President Obama, to try to separate these two and get them back to low-level arguments, diplomatic arguments of a type that is much more reasonable and rational.
Well, I mean, we'll look at U.S. clout here. It hardly seems very large or persuasive lately, but we'll look at that. Nicholas Burns, Rashid Khalidi, stand by. Alan Elsner joins us in just a moment. A couple of calls here. Aram is calling from New Britain, Connecticut. Aram, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello. What do you see, Aram?
Yes, I just came back from Israel. I was there for 3 weeks visiting family, and what I noticed that as soon as the three teens disappeared, the TV and radio all switched to 24/7 coverage of that that incident. And I know that in the past there were quite a few Israelis who were captured in the past and then were released quietly. And so it appears that Israel this time chose to make it a big media event. And so that really brings me the suspicion that it was deliberate, media. I think that every time that the Israeli government has fractures within the Israeli society between parties, they use the Palestinian, especially the Gazan, conflict to galvanize the people. And indeed, my friends, my relatives, whether left or right, religious, non-religious, were all watching the TV and you know, feeling really united. So I just want to make that impression that I felt being in Israel for this past 3 weeks.
Aram, are you Israeli or American or both? And what do you think should happen now?
I'm both. I'm Israeli-American.
Okay.
And I think that that the media and both sides, and I think it should lower the profile, and it really instigated all of this by the, you know, wanting revenge and all of that. And I think that the violence, simply the statements and all that should be lowered down.
Bring the temperature down. 40,000 may be called up, but maybe don't send them in. Aram, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. I want to bring in Alan Elsner, Vice President at J Street. It's a pro-Israel and pro-peace group out of Washington, argues for a two-state solution with Palestinian state living alongside Israel. He's a former news correspondent, joins us from Washington. Alan Elsner, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
How do you think about the way both sides are playing this conflict this time, all the emotions, the tragedies of death of young men in the last couple of weeks before this, and the changed context around it as it unfolds, Alan?
Well, it is a very difficult and very tragic moment, and it has exposed, I think, a very ugly side, both of Israeli and Palestinian society, the incitement, quite frankly, the racism, the hatred, the idea that a young boy could be plucked off the streets in a revenge killing. And I did hear the quote from Mark Regev, the Netanyahu spokesman. Mm-hmm. They have not yet delivered justice. What they have done is arrested six individuals, but they haven't been charged. And we've seen in the past, I think, Israeli extremists being arrested, being even sent to prison, and then quietly pardoned by the president a few years later. We saw that with the Jewish underground in the 1980s. I would like to go back to something that Michelle Dunn said at the beginning of,
yes,
of the show, where she referred to a very important speech by Phil Gordon, who is the White House coordinator for the Middle East, which he made yesterday in Israel. And I think that he made some really, really important points, and I'd just like to quote them. Israel
Please.
Confronts an undeniable reality. It cannot maintain military control of another people indefinitely. Doing so is not only wrong, but a recipe for resentment and recurring instability. It will embolden extremists on both sides, tear at Israel's democratic fabric, and feed mutual dehumanization. How can Israel remain democratic and Jewish if it attempts to govern the millions of Palestinian Arabs who live in the West Bank? How will it have peace if it's unable to delineate a border, end the occupation, and allow for Palestinian sovereignty, security, and dignity?
I mean, that's nice for an American to say that, but there clearly is not a governing majority in Israel prepared to act on that view. Why not? You know, people think, maybe they think this can go on indefinitely as it has been.
Well, I think one of the clarifying aspects of this crisis is that it's showing Israelis that there is no status quo. You hear a lot from Israelis. Yes, we're in favor of the two-state solution, but we don't have a partner. And in the meantime, life is pretty good in Tel Aviv. We can go to nightclubs. We can go to the beach. We can enjoy ourselves. Now, once again, we see that there is no status quo, and that if you continue to let the situation fester, it's only going to get worse. And so I think that those who say that this Israeli coalition is incapable of delivering peace and delivering the kind of concessions and tough decisions that are needed to get there are absolutely right. We need a political change in Israel. And I think one of the roles of the American Jewish community, where a huge majority supports a two-state solution, is to speak loud and clear to our Israeli cousins, our Israeli friends and family, and say, yes, we love you, we support you, but you are going in the wrong direction, and you need to change that direction. You've seen what occupation is doing to the fabric of your own society. You've seen the kind of things that it's bringing. You've seen that there is no status quo. Now is the time to get serious about this.
Let me bring in Kelly from Franklin, Kentucky. Kelly, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Just wanted to, I guess, throw my two cents in on... I listen to your show often. I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
Seems like every time any crisis pops up in any other part of the world, Americans feel like we must intervene, or at least our government does. And I think I speak well on behalf of the majority of everyday Americans in saying enough's enough. We need to take care of home. We're, you know, it's a shame that all these tragedies are happening everywhere else. We got plenty here, and we need to start stepping up here.
Kelly, our time is short before the break, but let me pick that up. Nicholas Burns, you hear Kelly's attitude, and it's hard to blame him in this case where this is repeated again and again and again for decades now. It's easy to understand why Americans would say, you know, forget it, you're on your own.
Well, completely understandable, but we are the most important outside power in the Middle East. We can make a difference. Hillary Clinton did end the rocket wars in December 2012.
But here we are again. It's only 2014.
Right. And we live in a globalized world, highly integrated in the 21st century, where problems in the Middle East can directly affect our life here in the United States. We saw that in 9/11. And so we just can't afford to say it's too hard, it's too difficult, let's stay home. Not in a globalized 21st century where we have got to be on point and lead diplomatically. I do think we should do more diplomatically and not always think that the military is our first response. But our State Department, our Secretary of State, their job is to be out on point and try to resolve problems like this. It's been that way for, you know, 60, 70 years as the U.S. has been the dominant world power.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Israel and the Palestinians squaring off in a region right now on fire. Here on CBS, Face the Nation on Sunday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, saying Israel needs to get to the truth about what appears to be a revenge killing of the young Palestinian.
When you start killing children, you set yourself on a path of it's hard to reverse, and I think a good idea to try to engage and get the parties back into their corners. But one thing about Israel, they will try to investigate, I think, and bring somebody to justice. The other side's not very good at that.
Yesterday, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest was asked if there is any U.S. effort to negotiate a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel.
It is not in the interest of either side for this violence to continue and even to escalate. So we are hopeful that even as Israel exercises their right to self-defense, that they'll leave open a channel for diplomacy to prevail and for a ceasefire, or at least a de-escalation in the violence, to commence.
Rashid Khalidi joins us, author of Brokers of Deceit, The Iron Cage, and Palestinian Identity. Nicholas Burns is here, was at the very tip-top of the U.S. State Department for a long time. He's now professor at the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, director of the Future of Diplomacy Project. Alan Elsner is here, vice president at J Street, pro-Israel, pro-peace organization in Washington. Rashid Khalidi, I'm going to come to you in just a moment. A couple of calls first. Ben in Austin, Texas. Ben, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question. How can there be a basis for a peace negotiation until the Palestinian Authority recognizes Israel's right to exist?
It's a good and simple question, Ben, and we'll pick it up. Let me get one more and we'll come to it. Wilhelmine in Iowa City, Iowa. Wilhelmine, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to remind Americans that each of us sends $21.59 in our taxes to Israel each year so they can burn alive Palestinian teens and other naughty little things.
I mean, that's pretty rough. But, I mean, yes, there's a dead boy here right now. But, okay, Rashid, first to the question from Austin, Texas. How can Israel do a deal if Palestinians are not ready to fully acknowledge Israel's right to exist? The question's been around forever. What do you say to it now?
I wish people would remember the fact that the PLO recognized Israel in 1988 and then in 2000 and then 1993 when the Palestinian Authority was formed. It was formed on the basis of the PLO recognizing Israel. The PLO and the PA have many, many times recognized Israel. That's not really the basis of the problem. The basis of the problem is that Israel is not willing to allow the Palestinians to enjoy self-determination and statehood. That's the core of the problem. This is a government, an Israeli political apparatus that is dedicated to the expansion of absolute Israeli control over the entire territory. Questioner mentioned that Senator Graham mentioned the Palestinians are not very good at investigation. Israel is in complete security control of the entire West Bank. It's the only power that actually has security authority. So the Palestinians don't have a real government. The Palestinians don't have the ability to investigate. Israel has been, Israeli forces have been entering West Bank cities and towns for the last several weeks searching for the people who murdered the three Israeli teenagers, the students in this West Bank settlement. Israel will not and simply has refused to allow the Palestinians to have what is necessary for them to have a life as an independent people. And as long as that continues, I agree with Nick Burns. I think violence is absolutely a futile endeavor, especially for the Palestinians who are so much weaker. But in this circumstance, it's going to unfortunately continue as long as occupation and settlement continue.
Rashid, let me ask you, before this outbreak, everybody was focused on the bigger regional picture, where you've got Syria in pretty full meltdown, civil war. You've got a caliphate declared, border posts being bulldozed and borders maybe disappearing, and maybe a new Kurdistan, Iraq all messed up, Iran, who knows where that's going, and the idea of even a region-wide sectarian war, Sunni-Shia. Does that change the big strategic calculus around this seemingly endless, intractable conflict in some elemental way, Rashid?
Well, I think one difference between this conflict and this larger regional conflict you refer to is that the United States is a party to this conflict. We give $3 billion to Israel. Those are American weapons that are being used to bomb Gaza today. 45 people are dead today because American weapons were used to bombard Gaza. We are involved in this.
Well, we were pretty involved in Iraq. We're involved in Syria. We're involved with the Kurds.
We certainly were. We are the ones who set up the sectarian structure, which has exploded in Iraq and has now spread into Syria. We bear a very large share of responsibility
for that absolute mess.
But in this conflict, Israeli-Palestinian, does this lead them to dig in both sides? Does it somehow sideline this conflict? No one will care about it? Does Jordan melt down and somehow this gets engulfed in a bigger regional scenario?
I think that Netanyahu and many Israelis will either sincerely feel concern about this, or in the case of Netanyahu, may cynically use it as yet another justification for maintaining the continued occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. But frankly, I think each of these has its own specificity, and each has to be addressed separately. They do affect one another. Everything in the region affects everything else. But I think each has its own specificity. And moreover, I think that the fanaticism and the extraordinarily dangerous militancy of this Islamic State and the jihadis behind it, while it has a number of its own reasons, mm-hmm. would certainly be positively affected if the United States would stop its biased support for Israel and would bring this conflict to an end. We have that within our power. Israel operates with American weapons, with American money, with American support. Without those things, it could not go on doing what it's doing. And everybody in the region knows that, including Israelis. They thumb their noses at our government. And our citizens just don't seem to want to, you know, decide that this is something that really concerns us. We think it's over there. It's not over there. It's us. We're doing it. Us, the American people, in other words.
There certainly have been plenty of settlements in the face of very high-profile American visits. Let's say Judy in Boston. Thank you for calling, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I have so many thoughts here as I'm sitting listening. First of all, what happened to the Palestinian boy was reprehensible, and I'm myself Jewish, and every Jewish person that I know was disgusted by it. And I just want any person who thinks that Jews didn't find it horrible, I want to let them know.
Fully heard. Thank you, Judy.
Okay. So what I do want to say, though, is that when you talk about the peace process, and I'm just one person observing everything, I think that a lot of people also forget that so many deals have been offered to the Palestinians over the years that the leaders never have somehow managed to accept, and a lot of people believe that it's simply because that Israel exists at all, and although the PLO, Rashid, said that it was, it recognized it, you know, 30, 40 years ago, many people would argue today, and if you just look at, a CNN message board, many Muslims or many Arabs don't think Israel should exist. They want it wiped off the face of the earth. And all the Jews, you know, there's an old rumor that all Jews should be wiped out and, you know.
So, Judy, how do we get out of this? How do we get out of it? Because
I don't know. And even I just want to say one more thing. Yep. Hamas spokesperson 1 hour ago or so on the BBC said that he thought, and this is a Hamas spokesperson, he said that Israel actually may have killed the three boys. He did not want to make any, he did not admit that Hamas had anything to do with it. He said, and when the BBC journalist pressed him further, don't you feel anything badly about these boys? He said, no, two of them were soldiers, which is not true. They were 16 years old and 19, and the Hamas guy said basically, well, it was okay because they were soldiers, so he totally felt that it was justifiable to murder them. When none of them were soldiers, they were civilians walking around.
Judy, I didn't hear that, but as you convey it, it's certainly a different tone, and I appreciate your call. Alan Elsner, jump in here. Two things. First, so many deals offered the Palestinians, and they don't seem to want to accept. Do you share that view? And what about the bigger regional context? Can this really go on indefinitely while the whole region, who knows where it's headed? It can seem very chaotic.
Well, what you heard from that caller was that, you know, the depth of emotion, and you hear it from Rashid as well, and the engagement in the blame game. Yes, there have been diplomatic efforts in the past. There was, Camp David in 2000, and historians and people who were there are still arguing, and maybe Nick Burns knows more about it, about who was responsible for the breakdown. But I do want to say a couple of things on the somewhat slightly optimistic side.
Good.
When Camp David broke down, the next thing that happened was the Second Intifada, which was actually instigated and encouraged by Arafat. We have in Mahmoud Abbas a Palestinian leader who has committed himself to nonviolence and is not instigating violence on the streets in the West Bank. Yes, we had some very ugly scenes in East Jerusalem. We had some very ugly scenes over the weekend in some of the Arab-Israeli towns. But the West Bank has been, incredibly given the circumstances, relatively calm. We're not seeing an intifada. I separate what's happened as a result of these horrific murders of the three Israelis and the Palestinian teenager from what's happening in Gaza with Hamas, because there you have a responsible leadership making a conscious decision to engage in a military confrontation with Israel for its own reasons. And Israel sending signal after signal that is not interested in an escalation, that it doesn't want to send in ground troops. But if and I think that this will go on until Hamas decides that it's had enough, that it's made its point, that it's asserted its pride, that it's shown its manhood, whatever. And then they will seek the ceasefire and will have the ceasefire. So I separate out the kind of emotional outbursts as a result of these very horrible murders, which should make everybody on both sides really take an honest look at themselves and search their conscience and look at the incitement and look at the way they're educating their kids and look at the hatred from this confrontation around Gaza, when you have Hamas isolated and almost broke, needing to kind of prove that it's still there and engaging in this confrontation.
Nicholas,
and escalation.
Nicholas Burns, let me come to you here. If the U.S. is saying to Israel, let's get to some agreement, a peace deal here, because look at the region, this promises trouble for you. This is not good long term. Does Israel not buy that, Nick?
I don't think it does. I think the American attitude in the last four American administrations, two Bushes, Clinton, and Obama, has been, now's the time to make peace when you're strongest. Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a speech last week where he looked at the caliphate being established in Iraq and Syria. He looked at the rise of ISIS and said, radical Islam is on our doorstep. Now's not the time to make peace. And I must say, Hamas has not recognized Israel. Hamas says, we're going to change things on the ground through violence. So you have a divided Palestinian community. And, Tom, your callers have given us such important issues to talk about. I just say this. From an American perspective, every American president since Harry Truman, Democrat and Republican, has supported the idea of a Jewish state, Israel, in the Middle East. We do have an interest in that, and we have to safeguard Israel. I negotiated a military assistance agreement with Israel, and proudly so, because the survival of that state is in the American interest. But here's the rub, and here's the problem. We have a major disagreement with Israel on the occupied territories, on the settlements, on the treatment of the Palestinians. So I think I'd sum it up this way. The United States has to be dedicated to Israel's security, but we also have to be dedicated to justice for the Palestinians. They deserve their own state. They deserve not to live under occupation. The only way forward is through diplomacy and negotiations. The wars, the rocket wars that we're seeing today in Israel and Gaza will get them nowhere, and we'll just see more people killed. And that does argue for the United States to intervene in a major way diplomatically to try to separate these two and restart talks, however Sisyphean they may be.
What's the American leverage? I mean, you said it yourself. You had the Secretary of State for a year in Israel 14 times. You can't be Secretary of State and devote much more time than that to it. And at the end of all that, zip, nothing. So where's the leverage?
The leverage today, this week, on the rocket wars is that no state listens to the United States, listens more closely to the United States than Israel, and we do have influence on that government. And I think we can work with that government to end these rocket wars. We do not have such leverage on Hamas. And so it's going to take another country like Turkey or Qatar to convince the Hamas leadership that they're heading down a road towards ruin and destruction if they don't stop themselves. And I think Hamas has been a major instigator of these rocket attacks on Israel.
Rashid, what about the U.S. role now? What should the U.S. do?
Well, I think something quite different than it's done in the past. I think it really has to put Israel on notice. I think it has to decide that it will insist on what Nick Burns said, that Israel has to move towards allowing the Palestinian self-determination. The United States has never really pushed this. I mean, I've done a lot of research on this. And he's right. Many American presidents have said very nice things about ending occupation. None of them have made any actual efforts to oblige Israel to stop using American money and American weapons for the continuation of occupation and settlement. I think failing that, we shouldn't be talking about American efforts. We should be talking about the United States as the main prop of the occupation and of settlement, which is what, unfortunately, we are.
But what if Israel says, look, as Netanyahu said last week, Nick reminds us, we've got radical Islam on our doorstep. This is no time to, you know, get all peace talky.
Occupation and settlement is the incubation of radicalism. Occupation and settlement guarantees that rather than the PLO and Hamas, you will get something much, much worse in the next generation. I don't look forward to such a prospect. I am telling you, however, yep. that is the way things are going to go if this kind of stubborn blindness on the part of our government, which is in effect, you know, allowing this to continue, goes on.
Alan Elsner, what's the prescription now, given all the regional change? Alan, are you there, my friend?
Sorry, I lost you for a second. Could you repeat the question?
Just what's your prescription now, given all the regional change and the relentlessness of this conflict?
Well, I come at it from a slightly different angle than Rashid, but I kind of come to the same place. I'm not so much worried about the external threats to Israel along its border. They are serious, but I have so much confidence in the Israeli military to handle all those threats as they have in the past. And whatever challenges have been thrown at the Israeli military, they've been very adept at adapting and handling them. I'm worried about the internal Israeli soul, about what occupation is doing to Israel itself, about Israel's democratic future when it continues in control of millions of Palestinians. And I think that actually is the greatest threat to the future of Israel. So that's what keeps me up at night.
All of this on the burner as this unresolved standoff right now, rockets flying and plenty of Israeli strikes and Hamas rockets headed out. We'll see whether this goes to more intensity or less in the coming days. We're grateful for the insight from all three of you. Alan Elsner, Vice President at J Street in Washington. Thank you very much for joining us, Alan.
Thank you, Tom.
Rashid Khalidi, author of Brokers of Deceit, The Iron Cage, Palestinian Identity. Thank you, Rashid.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Nicholas Burns, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you very much, Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.